Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the Bald Face Truth.
Well, we scan the planet and get the best audio cuts every day on this show. A lot of hardworking people working behind the scenes to make sure that everything is in place. And I essentially, I'm like the race car driver. I just put on the suit and the helmet and I climb in and I have faith that the wheels aren't going to come off. And most days they don't. So thank you very much. Later in the show, John Wilner will join us. My wife will pop in studio. We had an interesting adventure yesterday. Did not intend to do this. Let me get an idea of where you guys stand on this. Did not intend for this to happen, but it happened. My wife, during this pandemic, if I asked her what food she's craving that she hasn't been able to have, because we have been amid a pandemic, she would say sushi. She would say it's not, because it's not a safe thing, right, to go into one of those conveyor belt sushi places. And are you really going to order sushi to go? Maybe you do. But my wife has been like saying, every time we drive by like her favorite sushi places, she'll go, man, I can't wait till we can go back in one of those places. So yesterday, we were running an errand after the radio show together, and we happened to be driving by one of those sushi places, and they were seating people outdoors. And I thought to myself, you know what? It's just us. We've got masks on. Here's this business, and they're seating people outdoors. You don't have to use a conveyor belt, because I could think that those sushi places that use like the conveyor belt or the sushi things traveling along in front of everybody, probably not safe compared to like a regular restaurant that is following protocols. But we got out of the car and I said, come on, let's go get sushi. She's like, are you sure? A little nervous about it. And I said, yes, come on, we'll sit outside. We'll sit far away from somebody. Like, it's time for us to try this. So we go in, and the first strike for me was the fact that when we walked in the door, the hostess or the person who was greeting us did not have a mask on, and we had masks on, and quickly the hostess kind of grabbed the mask from around her neck and then lifted it up over her face. She didn't want to have the mask on, or maybe she was making a phone call. I don't know. I gave her the benefit of the doubt, and I said to her, she said, inside or outside? I said, definitely outside, and only if you can seat us far away from other people. And she said, oh, no problem. We've got a table way at the end of the patio that we can sit you at. I said, great. So they brought us down to the end of the patio, and they sat us down. And they placed menus on the table. My wife refused to touch the menu. She just kind of craned her neck and looked at it. And she had hand sanitizer with her, a little bottle of hand sanitizer. Every time she touched something, she sanitized. And I'm a little more trusting and liberal, maybe dumb, I don't know. But I kind of looked at the menu, and then the server came over and took our order and went inside, and presumably the sushi would soon follow. Well, to my surprise, I suddenly realized that there was some movement behind me. I had my back to the rest of the patio. I don't often like sitting that way. Maybe I was a gunfighter in my last life. I don't know. I like to be able to see the door and who's come swinging through the door. So I kind of turned around and noticed that the hostess was seating somebody at the table that was immediately off my right shoulder. And I looked at my wife and I said, are they going to be 6 feet away from us? And she kind of gave me the no, they're not expression. Now, in this case, Judah Newby, Alabama Adriana, what would you have done in this situation?
Oh, that's a really hard position to be in because, I mean, you want to make sure that you're considerate of, you know, all the parties involved. But I don't know, man. I'm not sure if I'd be comfortable there. It's a tough call. What'd you do?
Okay, here's what I did. First of all, I waited a second just to make sure, like, maybe they were just grabbing a chair. Maybe they're not really sitting down. Maybe the host is going to resituate the table. And I literally looked over, and it was a young couple, and it's not their fault that they're being, you know, seated there, and they've got a baby with them. And they had masks on. The baby's in a baby carrier, but I was immediately uncomfortable to the point where I got up out of my chair. I walked back into the restaurant, kind of trying not to draw a bunch of attention, but I walked back into the restaurant, and I said to the hostess, I said, can you come here for a second? And she walked over, and I walked her down kind of through the restaurant where you could see out the window. You could see the whole scene. And I said, you know, you sat us at this end of the patio. You have a whole bunch of other tables. You sat them right beside us. I said, I'm not comfortable staying at that chair. I literally could turn around and touch the other person on the shoulder if I wanted to. And she said, well, we're being told that we need to seat as many people as possible outside. And I said, I don't think that's how the protocol works. I don't know, you know, what county exactly we were in, probably Washington County. But I said, yeah, you know, my suspicion is you need to be 6 feet apart. So we ended up walking out of the restaurant. I said, I'm sorry, I'm just going to go. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News is joining us now. Did I do the right thing, Wilner? I walked out of a restaurant because they seated somebody too close to me, even though I had said, hey, can you seat us 6 feet away from people?
I probably would have done the same thing. So were you not in position? I have so many questions about this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you not have maneuvered your chair to a different part of your table to create more distance?
I could have got about two more feet, but I still would have been almost able to touch the other person on the shoulder with my arm extended. So I said to my wife, there's nowhere to go because we were kind of in the corner of the patio. So there was like I would have to jump the railing to get outside the patio. So I was like, you know what? Let's just go. And I just said and they apologized and they said, oh, I'm sorry. I said, no, it's not your fault. Like to the other couple. And I just said, we just walked out. But it's just too soon. Maybe I'm not comfortable. I'm still skittish. What's going on in the Bay Area? Are you guys eating in restaurants? Are you eating at a distance? Are you hanging out at pool parties? What are you guys doing?
Well, it's been back and forth here in Santa Clara County. We thought we were moving forward, and then the state declined our petition to advance to the next phase over the weekend. And then there was, you know, Bureau of Alcohol agents went to a bunch of restaurants, including restaurants in Gilroy and Morgan Hill, and basically shut down outdoor dining. And there was mass confusion. I mean, they're having outdoor dining in L.A., and, you know, the Bay Area is in much better shape than L.A. But now I think we've got it all fixed, and the state has approved our request. So in Santa Clara County, you can eat outdoors, and they're going to start to, you know, elevate the threshold for gatherings. But there still is no indoor dining. You guys have indoor dining?
They can dine indoor as long as they're at a distance.
Ooh.
Yeah, I don't feel good about it. My wife wouldn't do it because when we left the outdoor patio, the hostess said, well, you guys can sit inside. And I looked at my wife and she said, this is not going to be fun. That was the end of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I saw there was one of those big Wall Street firms, I think it was Goldman Sachs, they did this giant analysis of COVID trends. And the thing that they found that tracked most closely to upticks in infection rates was use of credit card machines in indoor restaurants. So whether it's bars or restaurants, that is like the correlates the strongest to upticks in infections.
John Wilner with us, Bay Area News Group. You had some big news today. Michael Schill, Oregon's president, now the chair of the Pac-12 CEO group. Why is that significant?
Well, I think there's a couple of layers to it, and I, since you know him, I'd love to hear what you think. But first layer is that he's taking over from Colorado's Phil DeStefano, who did a tremendous job, I think, in improving transparency in terms of what the Pac-12 is willing to release to the public about their financials. He did a great job in improving collaboration between the conference office and the schools and getting the athletic directors much more involved in policymaking. I think another layer to it is that the, you know, Schill's in charge, but the executive committee is now Schill and the presidents from Washington, Washington State. So, you know, the central power among the CEO group is all concentrated in the Pacific Northwest. I think that's very interesting.
It does make the Northwest matter more than maybe they have maybe ever in the conference. I think back in the day, the old Pac-8 or whatever might have been headquartered in downtown Portland. I was think it was the original home to the conference, but this is a modern shift that is big. I think Schill's smart. I think he's super smart. I don't think he's like the most knowledgeable sports fan, but I think he's somebody who cares deeply about his teams. He's very visible at Oregon men's and women's basketball events, football. He has been present. And I think he's a guy who really does understand and root for the teams. And but to give you an example, Wilner, I was in the press box elevator with him last season, and it was getting late in the season, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Hey, Washington's playing today. I think Washington might have been playing Stanford or something." And he said, "Who should I be rooting for?" And so he kind of wanted my advice on strategically, like the strategy of, was it better to have Washington win? I told him, always root against Washington. You're Oregon's president. So, but I think he's smart. I think he's super smart and very businesslike.
Well, the big thing is, and you know, I read the Q&A that you did with him. Is that early May? I think it was early May. And there was a line in there that I thought was pretty telling, where he referenced that he understands that football is kind of the front porch for the school. It is, for most schools, it is the number one marketing and branding vehicle there is to the entire country, in terms, whether you're talking about football recruiting or just student enrollment and applications for admissions. Football is nothing can help you better, quicker or better than football. And that what he told you in that Q&A made me think that he kind of gets that football is what the Pac-12 needs football to succeed in order to elevate the conference and the campuses on all levels.
I'm watching that CEO group, which are the presidents and the chancellors of the universities, for people who are not clued into that. You have the 12 members that are voting members there, and I'm watching that CEO group, and it's a whole bunch of turnover. Only two of the original old school presidents or chancellors remain that hired Commissioner Larry Scott. How do you think the new guard is different than the old guard?
I think the new guard is far more interested in how football does than the old guard. The old guard seemed to be pretty content to look at the number of NCAA championships in the Olympic sports and feel good about the state of the conference. Whereas the new guard, and part of it's because of their backgrounds, not necessarily Schill, but some of the others, you know, their backgrounds are in football, big football playing conferences, and their backgrounds are in the deep, you know, growing up in the South. And so I think they understand that football has got to succeed in order for Pac-12 athletics to thrive. It's not like it was in, you know, 20, 25 years ago, where, you know, the Olympic sports were closer in significance to football and men's basketball. There's been a, you know, there's a separation going on. If you're not good in football, you're just not going to have the resources to be able to compete in the other sports.
John Wilner with us, Bay Area News Group, San Jose Mercury News. July 1st.
Hey, has Oregon State's new president started?
Yeah, he's on the job. I haven't heard, a peep from him yet, but that happened July 1. He assumed the throne on July 1. Ed Ray will stick around and be a professor on campus in economics. So he's not going away. That's going to be interesting to watch, to see Ed Ray kind of faculty member over at Oregon State. But, speaking of July 1st, the new presidents and chancellors all voted and salary reductions in the conference offices, about 9% expenses cut in the conference level. What did you make of all of that?
I mean, they had to do it. Larry Scott had to extend his salary cut. They had to do the same for the highest paid executives. 9% out of that budget, my guess is that's about $9 or $10 million, just from what I, basic understanding of how conference operating expenses. I think a lot of it is just, trying to free up every possible dollar to get to the schools in these next 12 months when it's going to be such a scramble for them, right? Because if Larry Scott can cut his expenses by $10 million in San Francisco, then that's $10 million more dollars that they can distribute among the 12 schools, in theory. And there's a lot of pressure from the campuses on the conference office right now to be as lean and mean as possible. I know a lot of folks think that he should, and you referenced this in your column, he should maybe have taken a bigger pay cut given what his salary is. I think in some ways he was the beneficiary of the campuses in that regard, because they kind of told him, your cuts need to be along the lines of our cuts. So when presidents and chancellors are taking, cuts anywhere between 10 and 20%, that was kind of the methodology they used to come up with his salary cut. But he's obviously, his compensation is pretty significant compared to a lot of the CEOs.
Yeah, Oregon President Michael Shill took a 12% salary reduction on his own campus, so you can sort of see that the blueprint was laid there. One of the things I've been banging the drum on and feel like I'm getting nowhere is the headquarters of the Pac-12. It was an 11-year lease that they signed that should be up fairly shortly, like in the next year. Given that everybody's working from a distance, is there any shot that the Pac-12 either negotiates a reduction in that rent, $8 million they paid in the last fiscal year, or moves the headquarters altogether to somewhere that's a little more affordable?
It's interesting because the timing, and so many of the issues that are kind of hovering over the conference involve timing. Do they move? And I'm not sure. I think they moved. I want to say they moved in September of 2011. So if it was an 11-year lease, that would get us to fall of 2022, maybe. I'm not positive of that. But that, who knows what's going to happen starting in 2024. There may not be a Pac-12 Networks, at least not one that the conference is producing. So do you move as soon as you can, but then maybe have to move a second time? I don't know that they're going to want to deal with that. My suspicion is that they're just kind of holding out until that next media deal, and then they'll decide where they want to put the conference office and the networks, if they even exist. And that media deal is, basically going to get done in 2023. So they've got this little sliver of time that kind of it caught in between the two existences, and I don't know how they're going to manage that. You're totally right about how much it costs and how that, that could be a lot more money for the schools if they were, in Salt Lake City or Vegas. But, boy, I think they're stuck. They're stuck on that, and they're stuck on the fact they can't do their own streaming service because their contract with Comcast and the other distributors.
I had a CFO look at the 990 form that the Pac-12 put out, and what jumped out to him on the form was that not only were they paying $8 million in rent, there was approximately $11 million in deferred rent that was lingering. And he said at some point that comes due, probably at the end of the lease. So it could be much worse than we all think what it's costing them. Where do you put headquarters? Let me just throw this at you. If there's a network involved, I think there's an advantage to being close to a large metropolitan area like Los Angeles or the Bay Area, because you want the best talent, right? You want the best engineers and producers and camera people, and you're going to need to draw from that pool. But if there's no network involved, is putting the conference headquarters in Las Vegas where there is no team, is that a wild idea, or does that make a lot of sense?
I think it makes some sense. I think a lot of it will be determined by who their partners are. Who are their media partners? You know, is it ESPN and Fox? And if it is, then, you know, Culver City makes a lot of sense. Somewhere down in L.A., right? El Segundo.
Yes.
If it's Facebook or Apple, then, you know, probably somewhere in the East Bay, Contra Costa County makes a lot of sense, right, to be in the Bay Area. So I think that will be a huge component. And they're going to have, whether there's a network itself as there is now or not, you know, they're going to certainly have a close media partner, at least one, maybe two. So I think that will probably play a pretty significant role. You know, Vegas to me is probably either Northern California, Southern California, or Las Vegas, probably because you need to be somewhat close to L.A. just because, it's such the hub for so many things. And especially if you've got, a media company and you need talent and you need production help and all that, being within striking distance of L.A. to me probably makes the most sense.
John Wilner with us, Bay Area News Group, covers the Pac-12 like nobody else. We're seeing some encouraging data on testing. Notre Dame is a good example. They've only had one positive test, 251 negatives. But we're seeing other places that are kind of flirting around with a flurry of tests, and yet other places that aren't sharing at all. What do you sort of make on the early returns on testing? What can we draw as far as college football? What kind of conclusions might we draw early?
Well, I think the testing results themselves have been pretty positive, right? I have not seen a single report of any college athlete needing hospitalization, right? And a lot of the test results are asymptomatic situations. And there have only been a handful of schools that really have got these eyebrow-raising numbers, right? LSU, Clemson, a couple others. For the most part, you know, it's been kind of what you'd expect, and the symptoms have been mild, and the kids have recovered. The problem is the community and the world that the kids are living in right now, whether it's their off-campus apartments or whether it's going to bars or restaurants. That's the issue, right? The NBA can bubble their players. College football cannot bubble their players. Now, that's going to change a little bit. Starting, what is it, next week, you know, you have the gradual ramp up in training camp in terms of the number of hours that the kids can spend in the football facility. And the more hours are in the football facility, the fewer hours they're around and about town, potentially picking up the virus. So I think that's going to help. But then you're going to have another problem potentially in August, right, when kids come back. As for the semester schools, when kids come back onto campus, students come back onto campus bringing the virus back with them. So the problem for college football is the community. It's not the football facilities themselves.
John Wilner is with us. Phil Knight, the PK-80, was a big success. It brought some quality basketball to the Portland area and, you know, brought a big-time event here. There's now some news out today that another preseason tournament is being scheduled. It's being scheduled for 2022 and 2023. It'll be Phil Knight's 85th birthday present. It'll be held in Portland, and it'll be some big-time teams from around the country. They'll try to bring in some big opponents. What do you think's happening in college basketball with scheduling and maybe some of the premier programs in the Pac-12 that need a shot in the arm What's going to happen at Arizona? What's going to happen at UCLA? Where does the strength of this conference need a resurgence?
I mean, it's kind of like football, right? Pac-12 football needs SC to be good, needs UCLA basketball to be good, Arizona basketball to be good to a certain degree. So I think that's part of the issue. But to me, Pac-12 basketball has lost relevance compared to Pac-12 football over the last 10, 20 years, right? They used to be closer, and I don't know exactly why that was, but they just felt like they were more equal partners than they do now. Now, I feel like football just completely dwarfs basketball in almost every regard, and part of that could be because, you know, UCLA, the standard bearer for so many years, has not been that good. But Pac-12 basketball, they need something. I think that moving to the 20-game conference schedule is going to help. But I just think that it needs something to provide the whole entity with a boost. And it's going to be real hard this coming year for sure, right? I mean, I don't know how they're going to play non-conference basketball games. You think about how hard non-conference football games are going to be with the virus and the travel and the different testing standards for the home team and the road team. And then you try to think about basketball and playing indoors. I think the college basketball season is in a lot of trouble, and we could end up seeing a deal where there's no non-conference season. They just start playing conference games in January or February, and that's it. And that's certainly not going to necessarily help the Pac-12 in terms of getting some marquee wins.
You wrote about the Pac-12 possibly going with a conference-only schedule, creating some windows to make up games, really focusing on the Pac-12, just getting in it, the core of its season. I support that. I think it's a great idea because I think the biggest risk here is twofold. You've got people rushing to go back and play games when we're not sure what's going to happen. And then you've got non-conference opponents that you just can't control if you're the Pac-12. You don't know what Portland State's going to do to keep players safe. You don't know if Ohio State's going to take this as seriously or as diligently as Oregon. So, Wilner, but let me play devil's advocate here. That's a lot of money you're giving up in the non-conference. Can you afford to do that?
Well, I think that I think that there's going to be no choice, to be honest. I think that the presidents think that there's too much risk in the non-conference. Now, they could do, you know, you could, in theory, try to preserve the Pac-12 games against other Power 5 opponents. Oregon, Ohio State stays. Washington, Michigan stays, for example. But the games, like you said, against, you know, the smaller schools that don't have the resources to do the proper testing, those are just huge risks. I mean, we shouldn't name names, but, you know, you get an FCS or a Big Sky team plays your guys. They haven't tested properly, and then all of a sudden you got 40 guys testing positive 2 days later, right? I don't think that the Pac-12 is going to take that risk. But the money is huge. The exposure is huge in some of those games. You know, there's a handful of just colossal games for the Pac-12. I'm sure they'd like to keep those, but I also don't know that they're going to be willing to kind of bend for a few games and not for others. And I also think that the Big Ten, I keep hearing the Big Ten is further along than any other conference in terms of canceling non-conference games. Now, would it still be like that? You know, would they be thinking like that if it was Oregon at Columbus or Washington at Ann Arbor? I don't know. I'm sure, you know, but that's the Big Ten is, I think, going to be the first conference to announce conference games only.
John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News. On that point, when that happens, what happens to Oregon and Ohio State? Do they just put it on the schedule for 2037, or do they try to move it around and play it, you know, 2 years from now?
You know, I haven't looked at the two schedules to see how booked up they are, but, you know, they're certainly going to – the Ducks will want to do everything they can to preserve. Now, maybe that means there's some kind of swap, right? Maybe Ohio State's booked up in 2024, say – but they arrange some kind of deal to buy out the opponent to free Ohio State up to go to Eugene. There can be a lot of horse trading when it comes to the non-conference scheduling, but it could be tricky to find just the right year. You know, I haven't even looked at Oregon's schedule, yeah. And I know they like to, you know, Rob Owens is really good about scheduling at least one Power 5 opponent every year. So if they got to double up with Ohio State in a even year for a game in Autzen, you know, that's going to be one heck of a schedule that year.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of challenges, but you're right, we're on new ground here, and as we kind of look at that, and you got to kind of figure out, all right, what are you going to do? Because next year they do play at Ohio State, or they're scheduled to. 2022, they play Georgia in Atlanta. 2023, they're at Texas Tech. Now, they could drop Texas Tech and try to get Ohio State in there, but the 2024, they got Texas Tech again. 2025, they got Oklahoma State, and 2026, Oklahoma State. 2027, they're at Baylor, 2028, Baylor, 2029, Michigan State, 2030, Michigan State. So the first opening would be 2031. So,
yeah, and my guess is that they would want Ohio State to come to Austin an even year, right?
Yeah.
They're always trying to get 7 home games.
Yeah.
So it would have to be one of those even year dates. They'd have to try to find a way to swap out, and they would have to hope the Buckeyes can do it too.
I would drop Texas Tech in 2024 and host Ohio State there instead. That's the plan.
It happened to them, right? Didn't Texas A&M drop them, right?
Yes. But the problem is Ohio State is scheduled to be at Washington in 2024. So you got a problem here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that was the year they were going to go to Seattle. That would be... turn into some kind of bidding war between the Ducks and Huskies for Ohio State services that year.
Now look at you trying to drum up controversy. John Wilner.
Oh, yeah.
You're the best. Thank you for making time for us.
Stay safe, my friend.
All right. There he is from the Bay Area News Group. Leave it right here. I really do think you should subscribe to the podcast, to this radio show. Even if you're somebody who listens in real time, if you hear something you really like and you want to share it with friends, make sure you're subscribed. You can subscribe on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher. You can get a Bald-Faced Truth Radio podcast in all of those places. We will hit 3 million downloads. That just blows my mind. We'll hit 3 million downloads coming up here not too far away. It's amazing to me to look at sort of the statistics that and the data that we get on the podcast, because I do think it's just such a growing audience, and so many of you are listening in live time and maybe also podcasting when you can't get it in live time. So make sure you subscribe to that. It's All Alabama Adriana. I really have nothing to do with the success of that podcast other than I hired Alabama Adriana and I said, go make that thing better. And all she has done is decided how to present the podcast, the individual interviews, as well as the show itself that posts every day. And she does it in real time. So like John Wilner of the Bay Area News Group leaves the show, Alabama Adriana is already plotting, all right, I'm going to package this and podcast it as quickly as possible and make it available for listeners. So I appreciate everybody out there that subscribes to the podcast. Really cool to see that happen. We should do something special on listen number 3 million. If I have my isn't that cool? Like 3 million listens. Like Alabama.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Faced.
Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Faced Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Faced Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.